Well, what happened to the intro video?
Well, I don't know.
I think I do. Anyway,
oh well. Hey, welcome to the Geek Matrix DC Comics Review Show, episode number 194. I might have had that one wrong.
No, I do believe you are right.
Hell yeah.
194.
Right. We are here to talk everything DC Comics and comics in general from this week and beyond. As joining me as always is Josh.
Howdy, howdy, howdy. Don't mind me. I'm here for the bad jokes and appreciate them. The tip jar's at the door.
He's here all week, folks. yeah, we're fucking here.
Indeed, we are.
We're here. Can I say, I'm appreciating TNA wrestling right now.
Really? I haven't watched TNA in so long. And if I'm being honest, it's mostly because of one of my favorite wrestlers of all time.
Which
Sting.
One? Sting?
Sting. Yep. I look at him and I'm like, holy Ric Flair, buddy.
But why does that make you not want to watch TNA?
It's, okay, this is going to sound horrible, but it's the exact same reason why I don't want to watch AEW.
Yeah.
I am really super tired of seeing the same people that I watched wrestle when I was a kid get back into the ring. Would it be cool to see D-Generation X get back together and whoop the snot out of the Judgment Day? No.
Yeah.
All of them will get hurt.
Yeah.
All of them will get hurt.
Oh, for sure.
They're just, I mean, you know, there comes a time where you have to say, I'm past my prime. It's time to let the money go and let the younger talent shine.
Well, Sting has retired now.
I mean, yeah, but like what, 2 weeks ago? I mean, it was really recently.
But in his defense, even at the age he was at and the amount of decades he put into this career, he was still going fucking strong. Like he wasn't anywhere near like other talent around his age and doing all the shit that he did. Like he was still going through tables and getting up like it was nothing. The man is a beast. There's a reason he is one of the greatest of all time.
I won't dispute that. Like I said, he's one of my favorite wrestlers of all time.
Yeah.
I was a huge Sting fan when he adopted the Crow personality, the Crow look that he's carrying around or has been carrying around for like 20 years. But even before then, the Hawaiian Punch Sting, I fucking loved him too.
Yes.
I will always call him the Hawaiian Punch Sting. I don't care what
it is. Very fair, very understandable. Now, I will say with TNA, like there's not really any talents that I could think of that you would recognize that was around 20 years ago. Like the entire roster is pretty much different. It's like WWE is now. Yeah. Like there's no golden age wrestlers in TNA right now. And if there ever is, they're in a management persona only. Like Santino Marella is there and he's the, I don't remember what his unofficial title is, but he's like the GM.
Got ya.
Yeah.
Okay. And then on the other side of them, things like an AEW, and I know it's going to catch shit from you because it has before, but somebody really needs to tell Chris Jericho to go home.
I knew you were going to say that, and honestly, looking at him recently, yeah, not a bad idea.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, I get it. You're holding on for dear life to stay, you know, relevant because you think you're helping the wrestling industry and everything, but really he's not. I feel like his mic skills have degraded a little bit, and obviously his performance has.
Yeah.
And he's definitely not taking care of himself. So that bums me out. But there, I mean, AEW kind of like did that for a while, pulling out all the people that WWE let go or couldn't get into WWE or should have retired from WWE or wrestling, I should say.
Yeah.
I get it. Okay. Chris Jericho, he still wants to wrestle. Edge and Christian still want to wrestle.
Yeah.
But it's fucking time to move on.
I mean, for Edge, he's nearing that time. Like, this is his last stint, and he's said, like, he's only doing this for his eventual retirement.
I imagined that. Yeah. So as far as Edge goes, Adam Copeland, as far as he goes, I honestly had a very hard time believing that he wouldn't choose his retirement match to have Christian involved in some way.
Oh, now,
the fact that he had a WWE retirement match and then went to AEW, that I don't really agree with. That wasn't a retirement match. I mean, it was a send-off for the WWE universe, but I would say 40% of the WWE universe watches AEW too, maybe 30, but still.
I mean, recently it's gotten a lot less.
and it's I don't think it's working as good as it should be for wrestling.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of shakeups coming up. In WWE, by the way, have you heard any of the rumors for the draft?
I have not. I've been trying to stay away from those.
Yeah, me too. But I see David Meltzer. I can't help it.
Dave Meltzer is one of the biggest, like, when you're talking about like old school and needs to learn when to retire. Dave Meltzer's at the top of the fucking list.
See, there's Fightful. That's another one where I have such a hard time not tapping on the fucking headlines.
you know, Dave Meltzer obviously was the one that basically invented the star rating system for wrestling matches, right? It was his thing, and it's been adopted in the community.
But I actually had no clue.
Oh yeah, no, that was he started it for wrestling. So did you know that when it comes to WWE, he's only ever rated something like somewhere between three and five matches, 5 stars or higher? Ever.
That sounds like me with comic books. But
AEW has had many 5-star, some 6-star, 7-star matches. New Japan has had multitudes of 7-star matches. WWE has never had anything more than like a 6.5, and only ever happened five or more, like a handful of times.
Sounds like somebody has a little bit of a problem with WWE.
He claims he doesn't. I just think his rating system is bullshit.
Perhaps that's what it is too. Yeah. But I mean, it's Now I don't watch AEW regularly. I haven't watched TNA in fucking years. Actually, I think the last time that I watched TNA on any sort of an at least occasional basis was before it turned into Impact.
Yeah.
Which was quite a while ago.
Yeah. And now it's since the beginning of this year officially turned back into TNA Impact.
Yes.
But there is some kind of dull talent, but like the talent I've seen has been fantastic. And just a few notable names on my end, like Jake something. Stupid name, but I love it, and he is a fucking beast in the ring.
Jake something.
Joe Hendry. He's hilarious. Scottish guy, and he, when he has a rivalry, he comes up with these music videos that he plays just basically burying his opponent verbally. It's fan fucking tastic.
So it sounds like, it sounds like somebody made a baby out of R-Truth, Rick Boogs, and Chris Jericho.
Realistically, yeah.
That sounds interesting.
I was just watching a video TNA post on YouTube of every Joe Hendry song so far. I got to one of when he had a rivalry with Matt Cardona during the time Matt Cardona was calling himself the Indie God or the Indie King. And the whole song was just, you're an Indie God. You call yourself the King. But really, to me, you're just Edge's bitch. And this is just him. And it's just a picture of him from 20 years ago with the long hair. It's Edge's bitch, number one. Oh, my God.
That's awesome.
And he got Chelsea Green involved in it, too. It was fucking hilarious. Now, he's a funny guy.
Cool. And, if I'm being honest, I think part of the reason that I don't watch any of the other ones is because I already watch Raw, SmackDown, and NXT.
Yeah.
And that is a lot of TV time that my wife has to put up with.
Yeah. See, honestly, I started to watch TNA when it switched over, and I started with my buddy. And then I tried to keep up, but between Raw and SmackDown and reading comics and other stuff and this and work and child, I'm just like, I haven't really watched a full episode of TNA since I started watching TNA. And my buddy's like, why? And I fucking want to, because it's interesting, but it's too much. Yeah. I wish I could, though. Like, I'm okay even just watching a match here or there. Like, I showed you the match from the quote-unquote premiere episode of the new TNA.
Yeah.
Josh Alexander, Will Ospreay.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me is one of the best wrestling matches I've ever seen.
I mean, I don't know about that. There's a lot of things that go into saying something's the best wrestling match you've ever seen. But
well, it's not the absolute best, but it's one of the best.
I will give you that was one hell of an entertaining match to watch. Yeah. And Ospreay's constant pissing in the shoes of WWE is just, I mean,
yeah, that's kind of funny. that's he wasn't like that before. Like, there was actually somewhat of a not really a bidding war, but more of like, which way is he gonna go, WWE or AEW? And then he chose the latter. But AEW is, I don't think this is really Ospreay necessarily. I think this is more AEW just wanting to shit on WWE.
I mean, it definitely could be that.
They seem to be doing that a lot. Like, I still got to look into what it is exactly, but I think even they even had Edge saying something, not directly burying WWE, but basically saying there's a reason we're here. There's a reason I came here. There's a reason Chris Jericho's here, so on and so forth. Just like, come on, Edge. That's how I know it's just cheap shit.
Well, again, I mean, it kind of fits into what I was saying. There is a reason why there were that they are there, and it's because there's no more room for them in WWE.
Yeah, I mean, with Chris Jericho, it was, he's got a funny story actually about it. Like, he got offered this contract for the indie group. This is when AEW was just starting out, and he got a call about AEW, and he went to Vince. Was like, what do you think? Should I go for it? And Vince, in his own way, just like, yeah, fucking go for it, whatever, right? And then he accepted the offer, and then he went to Vince the next week. He's like, well, I guess this is my last show. And he's like, what do you mean it's your last show? He told me to take the offer. I didn't mean to take the fucking offer. He was kind of like accidentally put into AEW. When he was in WWE then, because this was like fucking 6-7 years ago, he was still in pretty good shape. It's only since he joined AEW that he's kind of looking worse for wear. I don't know what it is.
I mean, when he joined AEW, I mean, let's be honest, he immediately got put on top star status.
Yeah. And which is understandable.
Is understandable with the name that he brings, but at the same time, I feel like he's let himself go in more than just the physical way. Like I mentioned before, I think his mic skills have
they got a little rusty.
Lessened. Yeah. And you know, back when he was in WWE, sometimes his shtick would get old, but and then he would just change it up, you know. Sometimes his shticks started out old and then you would warm up to him. Yeah. Like you're on the list. Yeah.
He's got some great discussions about that, like how he always tried to stay fresh in his 20 plus year career between WCW and WWE. It's like he wouldn't stick to one gimmick for too long. Yeah. Right? He would let it run for a few months or a year, and then he would leave for a while and reinvent himself. And he did that consistently. And that's why there's so many different faces of Jericho. But with AEW, I've seen a lot of discussion online about it. Like, he needs to go do that because he hasn't, and it's getting old.
I mean, he just kind of walks out there and whines and yells and points fingers.
Yeah. But if that's all AEW wants, then that's all we're going to get, you know?
Yeah. Doesn't matter what I want, because it will never happen. But I would like a certain AEW wrestler to come back to WWE for his retirement match.
Daniel Bryan.
How'd you know?
Because he's the American Dragon.
I did not watch him while he was popular. But having gone back and watching his matches after hearing, like, yes, 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 and then no, no, I'm like, what the fuck is this? So I Google it, and it's Daniel Bryan, and I'm like, all right, so I'm going to go back and watch some of his matches. Wow.
Yeah, he's one of the best.
Wow.
He's so fucking good.
Wow.
And just think, he came out with Nexus. That was his debut on the main roster.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the Nexus, he's the only one still wrestling, as far as I know.
Like, God, that was so long ago.
I don't remember everybody, but I know a few of them have stopped. There was a guy with the red hair whose name I always forget, and his gimmick for a while was kind of dumb, but it was comedy. He's like, I've got kids or something like that. I think he's wrestling indie promotions, but not even Wade Barrett is wrestling anymore. Wade Barrett's the only one left in WWE from original Nexus.
Yeah, and Wade Barrett is the first one to always say how bad of a wrestler he was.
I mean, he says that. I don't think he was. I enjoyed him.
He shits on himself nonstop.
Oh God, yeah,
it's hilarious to me. Yeah. I love it. They really the shakeups that they have done with the commentary teams in WWE. Man, they have really, really worked.
Yeah. Like, I miss hearing Barrett and Cole together because they were a really good duo. Mm. But I like the duos as they are right now.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. And I never in a million years would have said, hey, why don't we go grab a football guy? But fuck me, am I glad Pat McAfee is here. And I never was no, like, huge Pat McAfee fan.
Nah, I actually couldn't stand him.
But when you get a commentator who comes in and he's enjoyable, he color commentates really well, but he's neither face nor heel.
I mean, that's the thing.
That's what I like. Because Corey Graves, let's face it, Corey Graves is a commentator, he's a heel.
Yeah.
Right? Michael Cole is a commentator. Barrett. Yes. And then Michael Cole as a commentator, he's mostly a face.
Yeah.
But having that lack of definition, where he just likes the wrestlers he likes and hates the wrestlers he don't. Yeah. That's fucking refreshing. That really is refreshing. Because, you know, I mean, while I love the barbs that go back and forth between Michael Cole and Bayley, that whole heel face thing between the talent and the commentators doesn't do it for me quite like I didn't realize how little it did for me until McAfee got there and pretty much changed the game for me.
Yeah. Like this is a definitely a new way to spin it, where they have two heel commentators on the same show and two face commentators on the same show, where they've always had a face and a heel. Uh-huh. Which I'll be honest with you, I've never cared for. I never enjoyed the fact that there was a face commentator and a heel commentator. I just couldn't stand it. And it always drew me out of the show with the commentary. Like every so often you get some great feed, like back and forth and some comedy moments. But for the most part, just like, oh, shut up. Like we know, like, why do you like this guy? You know, he's a bad guy. Just stop fucking talking. Shut up.
Yeah.
I couldn't stand it. When Jerry Lawler was the heel commentator with JR, that was one thing.
That was totally different, though.
Yeah. Michael Cole was a heel commentator. Honestly, looking back, really worked at the time. Could not fucking stand him. I hated Michael Cole. I did not want to listen to him.
You know now, who gets on my fucking nerves? Corey Graves.
I was going to say Corey Graves, but I was trying to say something else.
Corey Graves has gotten on my nerves since he started commentating.
I didn't like him at first, but he's really grown on me. And being a lead commentator right now, I think it suits him.
Yeah, I mean, he's play-by-play now. He's not color, so...
Yeah. I mean, yeah, honestly, the whole time he was paired with Kevin Patrick, he was pulling double duty.
Yeah. I mean, no offense, Kevin Patrick, but maybe you should be steaming towels. And that's not trying to be ignorant. Sure, there might be a place left in the company for you somewhere. I did not enjoy it whatsoever.
He's gone back to football.
Okay.
What you would call soccer.
He's going soccer. So football.
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 Yeah. He's gone back to that commentary, which I believe is where he started as a sports commentator. And then somehow he got pulled into WWE where he failed spectacularly.
He really did. He really did.
And I really wanted to like the guy, but he just didn't feel comfortable ever.
You could tell that he was very insecure in his job.
Yeah.
He was hesitant to start talking. And then if there was a guest commentator that came out, a talent or another person, whatever, he would overcompensate.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like he would just blurt. He would interrupt. He would say shit that didn't matter. He didn't think out what he was going to say before he said it. And, you know, I mean, maybe they need a performance center for their commentary.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they when they even had Michael Cole pulling double duty on two shows a week to try and just help Kevin Patrick learn from who has become the voice of WWE, didn't work. And it was really weird to hear Michael Cole be a color commentator. But it was kind of interesting at the same time. I wasn't against it.
No, yeah, because it really was different. And it kind of reminded me of back when he first came on the scene.
Yeah. And it was him, KP, and Corey Graves. And Cole and Corey Graves had a history together because they were commentary team together for quite a while. For the longest time, when it was the three of them, it just felt like Cole and Corey are just talking like old buddies.
Yeah.
And Kevin Patrick's just stuck in the middle like, do I interrupt? Like,
I don't have anything to say. I don't have anything to say.
What a spear.
But that's what it is.
It's a damn shame.
Yeah, what is also a damn shame is that the more that I have looked into some things about the backstage antics going on in WWE and the things that are leading up to NXT becoming their third brand, and the draft coming up, it is really looking like we won't see any teams broke up.
That's a shame.
It is to me as well. And I'm saying that because Cedric Alexander, what the hell is his name? I can't remember his first name. The Adonis is his tag team partner.
Ashanti the Adonis.
Yeah.
Are they in NXT?
They're getting sent to NXT in the draft.
Okay.
That's the rumor. So
it makes sense because they're getting on TV.
Yeah. They were featured in like a picture back in February.
Yeah.
But if they're even sending like those people back to NXT as a tag team, then I don't think we're going to see New Day or Judgment Day or any other day break up at all. We might see quite a few moving around, some pieces and stuff, but I don't think we're going to see any teams broke up.
The thing about that is, though, I don't think they're currently a tag team.
They technically are.
I don't think I've ever seen them tag team together ever.
They've tag teamed together.
Adonis and Cedric Alexander?
Almost positive.
When?
It was since I started watching a year ago. Cedric
Alexander was with Shelton Benjamin, and Ashanti was with Top Dollar. And then Top Dollar and Shelton got let go. And then Adonis and
Alexander,
they kind of just cruised around a little bit. But I don't think I've seen them actually wrestle together yet.
Oh, I could have swore that they were. Anyway, they're getting sent to NXT. And I know you were trying to avoid spoilers, but I'm only going to give you one more about sent to NXT.
Yeah,
and
I think
you're going to like it.
No, don't tell me.
Don't tell you?
I mean, don't tell me who I think you're going to tell me.
And you mean Chelsea Green?
Chelsea Green. No,
she asked to be transferred last week or last Monday. She asked to be transferred.
Chelsea. No.
But.
Oh, it's a SmackDown.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not to NXT.
No. I'm sorry. I said that wrong. This past Raw.
Yeah.
Cole said that Chelsea was excited about the draft and was asking NXT to get her out of here. But that's not the one that I was talking about.
Okay.
The spoiler, I said that one didn't count because it came out on TV. But the spoiler, and it's one that I think you're going to like.
And if somebody is going to NXT?
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Shinsuke.
Ooh, that is surprising.
Yeah.
This is a man that, I mean, I was going to say this is a man that's had a huge career.
Massive career.
And he started in WWE on NXT. Mm-hmm. But they've been putting all sorts of huge talent down there.
They have, and they're going to continue to do so. From what I understand, the plan is to turn Shinsuke into a massive heel.
I mean, like, he's been working his way there.
He's been working his way there, but apparently he's going to NXT to be the guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The one that's there to fuck with anybody that's a champion.
Yeah.
Basically. Excuse me. But okay, I won't spoil any more for you.
Well, now you got me curious. So I will say now that you know my policy when it comes to spoilers. Everything is a rumor until proven.
Yeah. Well,
so even if you tell me, like you're telling me that Shinsuke is going to NXT and that Adonis and Alexander are going to NXT as a tag team, I'll believe it when I see it. Like, it's one thing to hear it as a rumor, but I will not, and this is just me on principle when it comes to spending so many years looking up MCU rumors and spoilers. I needed to do it for my own sanity. To be like, okay, well, like, a lot of this shit isn't real. So at this point, everything isn't real until it's proven. So
that's fair enough.
You
that's
can tell me whatever the hell you want at this point. Cody's going to SmackDown.
I would assume so.
Yeah.
I would assume so, given that he's got the Universal.
Yeah.
These are just thoughts. These aren't rumors. I also think that with Rhea gone.
Yeah.
Who was the real leader of the Judgment Day that has no leader. That means with Damian Priest having just won the championship, he's going to have to step up and take that role.
He's already started.
Yeah. And I think that I think that's going to cause some major problems with Finn.
I think so. Something's got to give. And I think by the time Rhea gets back, Judgment Day is going to be broken up and she's going to go babyface.
That's what I think as well. Yeah. I think that she's going to be gone for almost 9 to 12 months.
Jesus, that long?
Yeah. It'll be 6 to 10 weeks for her to be able to start moving her shoulder, and then another three to four to get back into ring shape.
Jesus.
To be able to get her mobility back and all of that. But I think you're right, and I think Liv turning heel is a big, big thing. I think that they're going to continue to have her go toward the dark side, for lack of a better word. And I agree with you. I think when Rhea comes back, she's going to be a babyface.
Yeah. We will have to see.
Well, I mean, the crowd made her a babyface when she laid down the title.
Yeah, I mean, the crowd made her a baby face when she became champion.
let's be honest, but
I don't blame them.
It's all because she said mommy's always on top.
Yep.
But speaking of being on top,
you know, mommy is always on top, even when she's injured, because now she's on the top of the disabled list.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep.
Speak of being on top, I suppose we should get into comics and figure out which ones of those are on top, huh?
Well, before we get into that, we should get into comics and news. I didn't mean to talk about wrestling for fucking half an hour.
But it here happens we are. Every time.
It does. Yeah, so we got a few things to talk about. Starting off, we got our first reveal at the follow-up to Nice House on the Lake from James Tynion IV and Alvaro Martinez Bueno, returning with The Nice House by the Sea, which is set to release in July, on July 24th. Colors from Jordi Belair and letters from And World Design, which I believe was the same exact creative team as the first Nice House series. So this is the sequel, but don't expect any recurring story. It is set in the same world, but it's a new house, new location, new people. And instead of 12 people that know each other, this is 12 distinctly different strangers, each with their own profession or skill set, however you want to call it. This includes the doctor, the writer, the historian, the actor, the artist, the priest, the scientist, the singer, the politician, and the mathematician. And they are at the House by the Sea by choice. So check out the interview with James Tynion IV on AIPT.com as James reveals a little bit about the book and the story going forward. Certainly looks interesting. I can't wait to see it because, let's face it, Nice House was a runaway hit last year.
Oh, bye. And far, and yeah. I am not a Tynion on Capes fan in any way, shape, or form, but let me tell you, man, Nice House That man was born to write that series. Holy smokes. It's so good. I can't wait for the sequel.
Yeah, it's going to be good. Now, speaking of kind of sequels, we got our first look at the creative team for Action Comics following, House of Brainiac coming in July, starting off with Action Comics 1067. That's a three-part story written by Gail Simone. Hell yeah. With art from Eddie Barrows. And this is a story called Superman and the Challenge from the Stars. And this is actually taking place in the past. This is going to be back in realistically Superman's first year when he was a lot younger and he's just getting used to the cape and whatnot. And a bunch of aliens decide to attack. So the only person that can stop them is Superman. But during this, he does learn how to be that intergalactic hero in the future. So Gail Simone back on DC and with Superman. Like, I'm so stoked.
You don't even, me too. I'm bummed out talking to you guys in Discord and then going back and reading the article that you shared. I'm bummed out to find out it's only three issues she'll be on, but
for now. It's a three-part story.
Yeah.
It's not saying yet if that's the only story she's writing. It does sound that way, but it's not confirmed. We'll have to see.
It doesn't even have to be Superman, man. Just give me a damn Gail Simone ongoing.
I mean,
featuring the Batgirls.
Excuse me. I was going to say, you have Uncanny X-Men in a few months.
Yeah, I hear about that, but
I'll check it out just for Gail Simone.
It's been so long since hearing anything about the X-Men has got me interested just because of how fucked up it is.
It's massive. It's huge.
And convoluted, and if you want to be able to understand what's going on right now, you need to go back 8 years and start fucking reading.
Well, they are promising that this new era with all new creative teams and new books, you don't have to do that. It's starting fresh. You don't need to know all the history. There might be the odd reference here and there, but there's always going to be that in comics. But ultimately, you can start fresh. That's a great jumping on point. It's all new teams. They're going back to old costumes. The Krakoan era is done. And it's from the ashes, they say, is a new slew of books. What's annoying me, though, is that it started out as three and very quickly jumped to seven. Surprise, surprise. Not surprising at all. No. But the others are mostly like single character books. So they're not necessary, I'd say, as an overall to read. If you want to just read the core title, there's X-Men, Uncanny X-Men, and another one I don't remember the name. Yeah. But Uncanny X-Men, I believe, is the one Gail Simone. X-Force is there, but that's not the core three.
Gotcha.
Okay. Yeah. There's a third one. It's got a new preface title. I don't remember exactly what it's called.
But yeah. Excellent X-Men.
Could be. Could very well be. Ooh. Well, speaking of Marvel, they have also announced what seems to be an out-of-continuity story taking place somewhat in the future. And this reunites the creative team of Jonathan Hickman and Izzad Rabich.
Nice.
Rabich. I don't know how to pronounce the name. I apologize. It's called Aliens versus Avengers. And it's exactly what it sounds like. Earth's Mightiest Heroes are fighting the Xenomorphs.
As long as this doesn't turn into some kind of space version of like AVA.
I mean, that's funny you say that because the cover says AVA right on it.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I don't know that it's going to take place in space, but it is an older version of the Avengers, older, grittier, with some other heroes, and they'll be fighting Xenomorphs. Oh no, it says Xenomorphs will reach Earth. Okay. So it'll be Earthbound. And it's a 4-issue series. I don't think I see a month, but it should be coming this year. So that's to look forward to. There's your intercompany synergy.
Yeah.
I feel like there was one more, but I don't remember what it is. I'm trying to find it. Nope, I can't find it. Maybe there wasn't. There was a rumor mill about potential Absolute Comics, but I don't feel good about that one. It just seems like I don't believe that thing yet from Johnston. That last write-up about Absolute Comics. So we'll have to see. But basically, listeners, if you're confused, Ryan Johnston over at Bleeding Cool has said that he's heard more things through the grapevine, and that the supposed DC's answer to Ultimate Marvel Comics will be titled Absolute Comics, Absolute DC. And the description he gave is very, very confusing. So I don't even know how to describe it, so I won't get into it, but check it out if you want to know what he's talking about. I don't recommend it, because I don't think it's real. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think that part's true. I believe that DC might be planning something like this, but what he's just heard, I don't think is real. I think he's being given false information. We will have to see. It's yet to be officially announced, so it could all be bullshit.
Could all be bullshit.
You know? And that's all the news that's fit to print.
All right. That is all the news that's fit to print. So before we head off to a brief commercial break, let's spit out the comic books that we're going to talk about this week.
Let's do it.
Honorable mentions, Batman Offworld number 4, John Constantine Hellblazer Dead in America number 4, Crisis on Infinite Earths number 1, Facsimile Edition. And then in the main show, we've got Jay Garrick the Flash, Green Lantern, Jay Garrick the Flash number 6, Green Lantern War Journal number 8, Catwoman number 64, and Wonder Woman number 8. And if you are lucky enough to stick around and join us in Discord for the bonus show, you'll get to hear us talk about Batman, Superman, World's Finest number 26, Titans number 10. Superman number 13 and Nightwing number 113.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah. Well, those are the honorables and the comic books that we are going to be talking about today. If you'll give us just a minute so we can pop out and you guys can enjoy one of our ever famous commercials. For those who are not watching live, you can catch us up later on Spotify or anywhere else you listen. And, commercial break.
Oh, dear God.
And commercial break over.
Yay! Welcome back. So we are going to jump into our books for the week. Since we've already been here for 45 minutes, let's figure we'll actually talk about some comics. So we're going to start off with Jay Garrick the Flash number 6, the last issue of this mini run. I'm sad to see it go, but Josh, please fill us in.
I will do my damnedest to be able to do that for us. Jay Garrick the Flash number 6, written by Jeremy Adams, with art from Diego Orlotegue and colors from Luis Guerrero, lettering from Steve Wands, and a cover from Jorge Corona and Sarah Stern. I believe that this is the last issue of the series, but if I'm wrong, it's definitely the last issue of the arc. In any case, here we are. Jay, the Flash, having help from Mr. Terrific, calling out to all available heroes and using his terrific satellites, is looking to save Judy from Dr. Elemental, who kidnapped her. Meanwhile, Judy herself is spending all of her time, while strapped to a table, simply talking mad smack to the evil doctor. I love that part, as you do. So Mr. Terrific tracks down an energy signature after Dr. Elemental kicks his plan in. He goes there, and despite having to avoid lasers and fighting sharks with robot arms, he gets into Elemental's compound. Yeah, I just did say sharks with robot arms. But hey, sounds like frickin' a fun time. Sharks with
frickin' laser beams attached to their frickin' heads. That's all I could think about when I saw that.
That's probably where the idea came from. So he gets into Elemental's compound. Jay thinks he's beaten him, but Judy's life is still in danger. He races to save her before Elemental's weird plan of turning all regular water into heavy water succeeds. He wants to do that so because Jay, he feels, is his creation. He did it, and he wants to make the rest of the world just like Jay so he can gobble up all the power. Well, he smashes into a table, and we can see both Judy and Jay laying on the floor. Later, we see Jay recovering in the hospital and Judy loving every second of that. That's pretty much the book. The art and colors in here are fucking smashing. It's so perfect for this book. And Adams just write damn good stories. I think the wrap-up, even though the conclusion was a tiny bit fast, it was done really well. And at the end of the day, like the end of the issue, who doesn't like a picture of the whole Flash family together? Exactly. It was an excellent way to end things, for sure. I gave Jay Garrick the Flash number 6 and 8.5 out of 10. It was really enjoyable.
It was really enjoyable, but it also felt like it went by really quickly. And that's not a pun, though.
No.
I do appreciate the pun regardless. It's weird because it read rather quickly, and it got to the end, and I'm like, well, shit, they beat him, and okay, the issue's done. Is that it? that was fine. But then I thought about everything I just read. I'm like, well, actually, that wasn't as fast as I thought. Like, it maybe there just wasn't as much a dialogue as previous issues, and that's why it felt fast. But there was enough substance in this issue that it wasn't like a rushed ending. And at the same time, like, where else could they fucking go? So we did get more teases for the future because Dr. Elemental got away and was met by some shadowy figure who has a plan.
Of course.
And Jay got his daughter back, and everybody lives happily ever after for now. So solid issue, solid run, solid story. Jeremy Adams knocked this one out of the park for sure. Which he tends to do.
the dude writes right out of my brain.
Yeah,
it's not like this is the kind of story I would write. This is the story I didn't know I wanted.
Yeah, man, I'm glad it's here. Exactly. Between that, the art was really good, and I just love seeing Jay just be the lead in a book again. It was fantastic. Sure. This is getting 8.75 out of 10.
Well, right on. Way to go, Jay.
Way to go, Jay. And I am going to do something I have never been able to do.
Oh, yeah?
I'm going to read the next book physically, live, on screen. Because I got this book on the Brandon schedule, and it got shipped to me about a week early.
You gotta love some of them pre-orders, man.
Yep. Green Lantern War Journal number 8. So if you hear some page turning, I apologize. I'm loving this because I sat down to read this the night I got it. I'm like, I don't remember the last time I did this. This feels really good. I'm reading a comic fresh, brand new, physically. I don't remember the last time I did this.
Not a brand new one, anyway.
Exactly. So this is Green Lantern War Journal number 8, written by Philip Kennedy Johnson, with art from Montos, colors from Adriana Lucas, and letters from Dave Sharp, with the cover from Montos. And gorgeous cover it is. I'm really happy with the one I got. So we open in Baltimore.
Yeah, your cover don't look like that cover, though, does it? Yours
it does.
Very.
No,
okay.
Yeah, I got the basic cover for this one. The place I pre-ordered, they didn't have any variant covers left. So.
Oh, bar.
I know. So over in Baltimore, we see Shepard has arrived outside of Gardner's last known address, Guy Gardner's last known address, mm-hmm. Supposedly his apartment. So he rings the doorbell, which is kind of weird for an apartment, but...
Very weird for an apartment.
So he rings the doorbell, but it turns out to be a construct, and this turns into a hand which grabs Shepard, drags him inside, and proceeds to create a whole bunch of robotic drones to point all sorts of guns at him and demand who he is. Gardner is talking to him through the ring from far away, and they have a brief conversation until Shepard lets loose that John Stewart is missing. And this is when Gardner turns things around and says, okay, constructs are done. Apartment's a bit messy, but look, there's a system. Just don't move anything. You'll be fine. Just go to the back of my closet, behind all the boots, find something. This is the only way you're going to help John. Guy is not there because he's off planet right now. If you want to know more about that, Green Lantern number 10 last week? Yeah, I think it was just last week. Yeah. Was the first part of Guy's bogus Lobo journey or something like that. It's the backup. That's where Guy is right now. That's why he's not in this. Meanwhile, in the Dark Star of the Fen, which is officially named now, which is where John Stewart is currently placed, a whole bunch of... I can only assume our Dark Star constructs are attacking the aliens residing within. But then John gets involved, uses his ring, creates a whole bunch of constructs, a veritable army of his own, and fights back the growing force. He is able to harness his will to form a gigantic robot to take on... I don't remember what the guy's name is, but I thought it was Olgrun.
Olgrun is the guy behind it all,
Yeah, but the guy
of Olgrun from Warworld.
The guy that he's facing.
Oh, I don't remember what the hell his name is.
Yeah, I don't remember either. But basically that guy. And he's able to shoot him away. The guy leaves for now. And then we see the giant Dark Star symbol in the background get progressively larger. Then the people hear the mysterious alien called John the Builder, and they believe that he is the one to save them and help them escape, but John is not able to. As he says, he's no one's messiah, and he does not know how to get them out of there. Meanwhile, on Earth, in Metropolis and Steelworks, where John's mother is residing with the construct version of her daughter, she puts the daughter to bed and then heads to her own bedroom to go to sleep. But then from outside the window, as we know, keep in mind that this house is inside the Steelworks compound, outside is the window, she sees her dead husband asking to be let in. But what we can see is that this version of Henry is a Dark Star construct. He's a radiant dead construct, but he's asking to be let in, downright demanding at a certain point. But this is when the daughter arrives. Ellie Rose is able to scare the radiant dead away, and she then tries to send out a connection to John, but also at the same time send out more constructs to protect Shirley Stewart. Realizing that the radiant dead lantern named Varen is the one causing this to happen. Since Varen has such a big hatred for John Stewart, he's going straight for the family. John is not able to get any of these warnings, though, since he is trapped in wherever the hell he is. We still don't exactly know where or what it is, but we know he can't get out, and that the thing stopping them from getting out is getting bigger. And as it gets bigger, it will consume them, and they will cease to exist. But as Byla Vok, who arrives again, reveals, if John is able to destroy it, it will send ripples throughout the universe and destroy everything else instead. Meanwhile, over in Baltimore in Guy's apartment, Shepard does exactly what Guy asks, moves a couple of things to the back of the closet, including just disgusting clothes, and finds what seems to be, according to Guy, the Book of Oa. To which he asks Shepard, don't let any of the other guys know I have this. They'll be a little jealous. Face it, Guy, you fucking stole it. Two notes right off the bat. One, that Book of Oa is a lot smaller than the last time we saw the Book of Oa. I don't know if it has the same technology as the rings, but the Book of Oa last time we saw it was fucking huge. It right. was like the size of a house. Now mm-hmm. it fits in Shepard's hands. So that's one thing, but I'm not against it.
It's the Cliff's Notes version.
It's the Cliff's Notes of the Book of Oa, the recorded history of the known universe. Yeah. Also, how the fuck did Guy get it?
He's what? Guy.
What is he doing at the Book of Oa? And why
whatever
is
he the fuck he wants
in Baltimore? What a place to keep it.
The back of the closet is the only place it would make sense for Guy to have it.
Oh, yeah. That or under his mattress.
That or under his mattress. Well, that's where he keeps his sticky porn.
We know Guy's got better class than that. His porn's on a computer.
Nonsense. Guy likes it old school, and you know it.
Yeah. So yeah, that was an interesting reveal. I'm really stoked to see what's going to happen there. What answers could the Book of Oa hold? Like, it supposedly tells a bit of the future as well, so chances are Shepard will find out some stuff about the Dark Stars and the Radiant Dead and whatnot within the Book of Oa, but I'm very curious to see where this is going to go.
I mean, that's flat out what Guy says, right? If you want to find out anything about these people, this is where you're going to do it.
Exactly. So it's a bit of a three-way issue. Not much happened apart from the stuff with Shepard. We got a small reveal about how stuck John really is, but his position didn't really change much. So I'm going to say not much really happened when it comes to John being stuck where he is. Except he did some badass stuff, like as he does. So not like realistic, it doesn't feel like much happened in this issue. It really doesn't. This was kind of just a stepping stone issue to me anyway. I really like the stuff with Shepard, so I'll give it that. And the art is fantastic. So for now, it's getting an 8 out of 10.
All right. Okay. We're pretty close in our opinions of this. But first, before I start, I wasn't on the show where we talked about this. I said not on the show where we talked about this. Excuse me. My bad.
Talked about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Wait a second here. Yeah, it was Green Lantern number 10. It was last week, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I wasn't around to talk about it. But since the issue had a callback about what Guy was up to, and that made me remember what the backup was, I was like, okay, reading that first. First, I want to mention, in that issue, they did Kyle wrong in Green Lantern number 10. At least for now. He seems really simpering. Save us, save us all, falling to the floor all sad, mumbling. And
Brandon and I, you missed it, we had a deep discussion about that. And we had some good theories about it.
Well, without hearing any of those theories or whatever, I walked away with my theory being I'm disappointed. And honestly, other than the Space Dolphins, the backup kind of let me down too, the local stuff. I was looking forward to more. However, seeing all those Space Dolphins swarm guy was pretty cool. I dig it. But anyway, as far as this issue goes, I'm going to start this review off by saying, wow, I feel like it just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and it manages to do it without getting convoluted or hard to follow, which is something that is really easy to do when you're telling a deep Green Lantern story. John's in a hell of a pickle. Hal and the Resistance are in a hell of a pickle. And Kelly, who I've wondered about for a while now, she's a prisoner. She's being experimented on, it looks like. Everybody else is in a pickle. They might be trying to turn her into a pickle. And then you top all of that off with Guy being in possession of the Book of Oa, and you've got a Woa. I think that this was great. Art and both halves, story too. I'm loving the Green Lantern universe right now. I gave it an 8.25 out of 10.
Fair enough.
I try to be.
Now, I'll tell you this about Kyle.
Go for it.
The idea we had is, if you look at the two appearances he's had so far, since all this happened with the United Planets, not counting the Look into the Past where all the Earth Lanterns were together even before Kilowog died, for example, right?
Right.
We saw him in his solo backup from Ron Mars, where he spent the issue, and it was kind of awkward, but he spent the story just talking to Alex, reminiscing about the past, and saying how much he misses her, and how much he wishes he could go back to the way things were, and just have the adventures he used to have. And that felt almost compassionate in a way.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we see him here, and he's very scared. He's full of fear about all sorts of stuff. And he even says right then and there, the emotional spectrum is in flux. Like, there's something wrong with it. And if you remember, once upon a time, he was the White Lantern. Yeah, that power doesn't necessarily just go away, I imagine.
At the very least, his connection to it does.
Exactly. But he built his own connection. He wasn't gifted the connection. He built the connection himself by mastering all of the emotional spectrum one by one. So that's what I'm thinking, is that with this emotional spectrum being in flux, his connection to each of the colors is also in flux. And that at random times, each emotion could be spiking within Kyle. And it might lead to him becoming a White Lantern again.
We'll
have to see.
What was it? Two months ago where I said that was a possibility? I really, 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 really fucking hope so.
If you think, like, he's already shown compassion, if not also love, and now fear. There's two or three out of seven right there. Right?
Yep.
If he shows rage or hope or greed at some point in the next couple of issues, I'm calling it. Like,
yeah, guaranteed.
Yeah. You know, this is definitely a thing that could be happening. So that's why I wasn't so shocked at first about this. It did feel weird, but then I thought about it. I'm like, there's got to be a reason for this. Jeremy Adams doesn't do these things by accident. You know, you're muted.
I am muted. And I said, yeah, no, you're right.
Yeah. So we'll have to see. A couple more weeks will be issue 11. Hopefully we'll get more info.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Speaking of fingers crossed, I don't know where I'm going with that. Hopefully she stays alive is what I'm saying.
Yeah, fingers crossed. Ain't nothing but luck and nine lives for Catwoman. Exactly. And number 64, written by Tini Howard, art by Carmine Giandomenico, and colors from Veronica Gandini, letters from Lucas Catoni, and a David Nakayama cover. In space, no one can hear you steal. Or at least that's what the cover tells us. Yet inside the book, it says, in space, no one can see you steal. Either way, let's see. So we kick this off with Viceroy. Actually, let me show you the cover first. We kick this off with Viceroy and the others starting the meeting that they began last issue with her saying that she can take out Catwoman. I guess they call themselves the White Glove, and in this issue we find out that she has inside info, and can track Catwoman to anywhere she is, which is currently Las Vegas. And Catwoman knows it. Shutting that down is the plan for this issue. She breaks into Ferris Air to steal a top-secret space plane so she can get up to the satellite that's tracking her and shut it down. When the plane gets stolen, none other than the demolition team shows up. Scoop Shovel, Jackhammer, Steamroller, Hard Hat, and Rosie the Riveter. And they're identified in the book, for those who don't remember the demolition team. And they say that they're going to go get the space plane back. Side note here, they actually acknowledge that the Green Lanterns have something going on that locks down the whole planet by saying that she's only going to have to go into low orbit. So I think that's cool. I love it when comic books keep their shit together, even if it doesn't play into the story at large. Catwoman acknowledges what's going on in the greater DC universe. Anyway, so she goes out for a moonwalk to mess up the satellite, and she's successful. Meanwhile, she's getting warnings about the space plane's weight limit being too high, and she assumes it's because she didn't drop an empty fuel tank or something. She finds out she's wrong when her tether is cut and the space plane starts to fly away. So here we are, Catwoman stuck all alone in space. She will come back if she dies, but there's not going to be any oxygen for her to breathe, so she'll die again and then strangle, asphyxiate, and then die again. And she's only got 3 lives left. So thankfully, someone swings by to snatch her up. Not so thankfully, it's the demolition team, the one who stole the plane. So with some antagonizing, a fight breaks out as Catwoman wants to go back to Earth and the team wants to keep her a prisoner for the bounty that's on her head. Well, that doesn't work out. Drinking Rosie, Catwoman uses her to ruin the plane and do a free dive back into Earth. She doesn't know how many times she has died, but she crashes to Earth in a gigantic ball of fire, setting everything around her ablaze. We barely, and I mean barely, get a peek at the crash site, and the caption for the next issue reads, "A Deal with the Gods." In the crash site, when I say you barely get a look, it almost just looks like a hunk of meat sitting there. So let's see what fucking happens, because that was nasty. Well, we're going to have to see how that works out. Catwoman, not just the issue, the title, the series is epic. Not as long, but as in awesome. It's been kicking ass since Ron V wrote it, and Howard's done nothing but make it better. The art, colors, story, the voices, everything is just great here. A couple of complaints with the art and a little iffy with the way that the space plane was destroyed. But other than that, I feel like this hits every nail on the head. I gave Catwoman 64 an 8.5 out of 10.
Oh, I completely misheard your score. I thought you were saying you were giving it a 64 and 8.5. Oh. I was like, what? I pretty much agree with everything you said. It's been solid. It's been very enjoyable. That crash site at the end, that was pretty nasty. And I flipped through this issue first and saw how it ended and just thought, oh God, no, it looks like all her lives are gone. Like, she's just dead. But then I got to like reading it properly and I saw that at the end again, and no, she has one life left. Or one resurrection left, I'll say.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see what's going to happen next. This has been a heck of a story arc. Excuse me. Very enjoyable. Very different for Catwoman, I'll say. But also very... how do I say it? Like, to the point. Very, very classic at the same time. To have a Catwoman story of, like, she's going back to performing heists, stealing stuff, but there's also a level of supernatural ability involved. So I'm all for it. It's also going to get an 8.5 for me.
It's good stuff, man. It's good stuff. Now, I want to apologize to you, Rob. Because we have to move from a book that I called epic as in awesome to a book that truly makes me wonder.
Whoa, man.
You want to tell us about it?
That didn't go the way I thought it would. I guess if you insist. It's Wonder Woman number 8. This is written by Tom King with art from Daniel Samper, colors from Tobin Mori, and letters from Clayton Cowles. I will tell you right away, the art, really fucking good. Like, really fucking good. There's
it's Daniel Samper, man.
Yeah.
But who did you say wrote it?
Tom King.
Oh, that's nasty.
Wow. I haven't heard Cleveland in a long fucking time. but no, the art is hella good. There's two types of art style here, and both are fantastic. I want to say that right away, so that saves me time at the end to talk about everything else. So bear with me, because I'm a little confused about this too. We open up on a 1950s analog style of Diana and Steve as a married couple. Very classic. Diana's the housewife, cooks, clean, stays in shape and whatnot, while Steve, the husband, smoking a cigar, working, reading the newspaper, blah, blah, blah. But he's being a total dick about it. He's one of those old, like, 50s style dickheads that you just want to punch in the throat because he's a
dickhead. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Fucking dick, eh? The whole time that she is having these conversations with her quote-unquote husband, she's having thoughts about what's going on in the real world, which is the lasso of lies has her bound to a chair, but it apparently has some, I don't know if it's, when I was reading, I thought it was like spikes in it or something, but it's so tight. And as she's wriggling and writhing her hands, it's cutting into her skin and making her bleed. She's not tied to a chair. Sorry. She's tied to a pole, a steel beam, being interrogated and told stories by the sovereign. And this man is just giving exposition the entire fucking issue, between Bible verses and tales of his childhood, which details why he is the way he is and the family he came from, how his mother was horrible and a drunkard, and his father regularly shamed them and beat the children. He just took that to his adulthood, where he's now an old man and the quote-unquote king of America, supposedly. We do get a brief reprieve from this back and forth of hell, where we see the Wonder Girls, I will call them, interrogating Sergeant Steele by tying him to a tree, putting an apple on his head, as Cassie is blindfolded to the point that she swears she cannot see anything and says, look, I know I can hit this apple with a bow and arrow blindfolded. Just let me do it. It is maybe the most entertaining part of the entire issue. I don't know how you felt about it, Josh, but I really liked it. Especially with Yara's just backhanded commentary over the entire fucking thing. That was funny. She's just not impressed by anything. Yeah, almost takes one of his nuts off.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. But then we go back and forth to the 50s analog, and Steve's getting worse and worse to the point that Diana can't take it anymore, and then her mother appears within this dream world, and
yeah, because she knows it's all bullshit.
Yeah. And then reminds her daughter that while she was growing, she
didn't listen to anybody. She was her own person, and she didn't let anybody keep her down. But then also her mother, knowing she's held down by the rope of lies, the lasso of lies, reminds her mother that this rope that I'm bound by, like the lasso of truth, it cannot be broken. It's unbreakable, as you told me. But as Hippolyta says, yes, I did tell you the rope cannot be broken, but when did you ever believe me? And this is when Diana snaps out of the dream world, breaks the lasso, and goes straight for the Sovereign, to which she is then met by all sorts of armed guards who then proceed to shock her, but she is just not having any of it. And just basically just shocks it off, shrugs it off, and is still holding the Sovereign hostage. That's to be continued. Next issue, hopefully we'll get to see some fucking action. In the backup, we see John and Damien now at the Fortress of Solitude, still babysitting Lizzie, as Lizzie has some history homework to take care of. She has a paper she has to write. John has just come back to find that Lizzie is not there, and the Time Sphere is also missing. Damien, the whole time playing a game on his phone, just lets John know that, yeah, she needed to write a paper on Samurai, so she took the Time Sphere and go back in time and meet Samurai and get the real story. The whole time, John is screaming at Damien that it's going to mess everything up, and we see them change form throughout as history is getting rewritten and time is changing. But then Lizzie comes back after all her adventures, and everything goes back to normal somehow, some way. Yeah. That was the thing. Did you see what I saw? Like when I told you, tell me that's not Kenshin.
Oh God, yes, I saw exactly what you meant.
Yeah, this World's Finest Part 5 was written by Tom King with art from Belen Ortega, colors from Alejandro Sanchez, and letters from Clayton Cowles. And the samurai that Lizzie goes back in time and meets looks an awful lot, not 100% in facial features. There's a beard for sure, and the X scars in the wrong spot, but looks an awful lot like Kenshin from Rurouni Kenshin, aka Samurai X, if you only watched a Reddit in the USA.
One of my all-time favorite mangas.
I
believe that ours too, me and Holly. I believe the full name of the original manga is Rurouni Kenshin Sword Romantic Story, or something along those lines. Most likely.
There's usually a subtitle as well. In fact, like when I first saw it, I couldn't even get into the story because I would just, like, every time I see a sword, I'm like, is that the battle sound? Is it reversed? Is that blade on the wrong side? And I'm like going back and forth between an image of Kenshin and this guy. I'm like, okay, but the sheath is going the wrong way. It doesn't look like the Batsu-san, but it could be. What is he doing?
All right, so you asked me if the backup, if the samurai was Rurouni Kenshin. I don't think so. At least I hope it wasn't supposed to be. Dude's got facial hair, like you said.
Yeah. But,
like, which I mean is...
Okay, I don't think it was ever supposed to exactly specifically be Kenshin, but the design.
Yeah, see, he's holding like his sword iconic. Backwards. The sheath is backwards, and the X scar is in the wrong spot. I could forgive the facial hair if I had to, but the sword is the whole thing that makes Kenshin who he is. So,
yeah,
I mean, I get that, and maybe flipping the sword the wrong way is how they were able to use it without any kind of legal ramifications. But dude is dressed exactly like Kenshin. Same exact clothes, same colors. There's the ponytail. There's even light play going on that makes his hair is like chestnut or auburn or whatever, so it's got red tints to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I hope it wasn't supposed to be. It was a cool little nod if it is Kenshin, but I hope it wasn't supposed to be.
No, I don't think it was supposed to actually be Kenshin. I think this is just Belen Ortega giving a nod to one of his own favorite manga series, which you and I will definitely agree with.
Oh yeah. And the movies are awesome too.
Yeah. I actually still have to like watch it.
Oh my god.
I only ever read the manga, and like I watched bits here and there of the anime, but like I never really enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed the manga.
Omi, I'm talking about the live action movies.
Oh yeah, I couldn't even start that. I just haven't yet.
They are awesome.
Yeah. Did you read the original manga?
Yeah, I did. Long time ago.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
It's so fucking good. That was high school. It is.
And the live action movie.
Yeah.
Movies, excuse me. They follow it so good.
Yeah.
Yes. Like
I need to see the whole cast of characters.
I was not disappointed in any way, shape, or form.
Right on. That's I really should check it out.
You really should. But as far as Wonder Woman goes, I'm sorry, did you finish yet?
I guess.
did you give a score?
No, review I didn't even start because I don't know what the fuck to say apart from I was lost, I was bored, I didn't understand the Bible verses. When the Sovereign starts talking, I tune out. I skip over his dialogue more than I've ever skipped over anybody else's dialogue. I give it the old college try. I try to read every little thing the Sovereign says in all the little text boxes during the side stuff. But eventually I'm just like, okay, this guy is saying so much while saying absolutely nothing. So I'm not going to waste my time. I'm just going to read the actual fucking story. So that's what I did. You asked me what the Sovereign said. I couldn't fucking tell you apart from stories about his childhood and Bible verses. That's all I got.
women should be in servitude.
Yeah.
That was basically it.
Yeah. Whatever.
Right.
Dickhead. Yeah, for the art alone, I'll give it a 6.
All right. Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. So like Rob said, the first part is Bible verse, fuck you and your Bible verses. Wonder Woman wins. I didn't find it engaging at all. It's the way King writes and some of the decisions that he makes in his stories. It feels more like studying for a test in high school in the one class that you hate the most. It's just a chore to get through. And if there's any comic readers out there that would be good with some good old-fashioned shitting on the church, it is me. But the whole message of this entire run has been done before, and it's been done so much better. And then we go to the backup, John and Damian changing into a whole bunch of characters because Trinity is in the past. It's weird. Trinity messing with history would not change who they are entirely. You see them turn into robots. You see them turn into Lex Luthor. It's stupid. And side note here, Nathan, John saying, honey, I'm home to Damian doesn't make them dating. I've said that plenty of times, showing up to work or coming back from lunch. To co-workers, and that doesn't make me dating Alec. So, you know, it's just something people says. Regardless, though, this whole Trinity thing still stinks. The last thing that the Wonder Family needed was another Wonder Girl, and if Diana is still Wonder Woman, like Trinity keeps saying, then Yara and Cassie are still Wonder Girl. So there's three of them fucking now, but whatever.
Hey. I may have said it's the Wonder Girls, but Yara is not a Wonder Girl. She says she's Wonder Woman.
She calls herself Wonder Woman. But her like official title is Wonder Girl, and everybody else calls her Wonder Girl.
Fuck your official title. She's Wonder Woman.
Well, then Diana needs to move on.
You're an official title.
Oh, I wish. Actually, no, I don't. I would hate to hear somebody go, man, you're a Josh. That would suck. Yeah, so ultimately, whatever. Semper and Ortega's art is the shining star in this issue. And considering that, just because Sampier's art is flawless in everything he does, and Ortega's is beautiful.
Yeah.
And because of those, I also gave it a 6 out of 10, which is why I said it was interesting, because Rob and I, we don't usually give it the exact same grade when we hate stuff.
We really don't.
Daniel Semper and Ortega are some of my favorite DC artists right now, so they really did help out a whole lot.
Yeah,
at least the score anyway. Didn't make the story any better, but hey, you know, can't win them all, I suppose.
Nope, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, indeed. So,
that being said, I didn't even mention the backup in my review. Damien felt way out of character here. I didn't like it.
I didn't like it either.
Yeah.
I didn't like any of it.
I honestly don't mind Lizzie Trinity.
There's a better Trinity. There was a Trinity before he invented Trinity.
And that's fine. I like the aspect of it as with the Trinity of Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, you have Superman and Batman's kids. And then, there's Wonder Woman's kid too. And it just makes sense. They're found family. And I love that aspect.
It's not a found family. It's a forced family. And Wonder Woman did not need... Wonder Woman is a princess warrior, chief representative of Themyscira and all Amazons. She's a world-class, universe-class superhero. And... what's the one thing Tom King decides she needs in a series where it's all about women having to bow down and kowtow to men? A baby. Jesus fucking Christ. Take her boots off. Put her barefoot in the kitchen. I don't see a reason for Trinity, and other than maybe, you know, goofy ass alternate universe stuff,
it could very well be alternate universe.
And that's the only place that shit belongs. Me personally, Wonder Woman shouldn't ever have kids. She's not about that. That's not what the character even comes close to saying to me.
Accidents happen. That's all I can say.
not on Themyscira. You want a fucking kid? You got to sculpt it out of clay, bone a god, and make lightning things. That's not an accident.
We don't know who the father is.
It's like you didn't like slip and fall and land on a pile of clay.
What I like about Trinity end of the day is the connection with John and Damien, that they are like the found family, the three of them, that their parents were very close friends growing together as superheroes in Justice League and became ultimately a trio of best friends. And then these three, through whether you want to call it nepotism or just fate, being the children of those fabled heroes, obviously you have grown up together and now see each other as siblings. John and Damien realistically did. Even though John got aged up, they did technically grow up together.
Yeah, no, I'm not disputing that.
Yeah.
Trinity was invented and introduced as a teenager and didn't appear anywhere. So they can't have grown up together. And if we say that Trinity came along later, horseshit.
They're babies.
Then they didn't. Then of course, they didn't.
What's happening in the story?
But at the same time, that's fine because it is. That is what's happening in the story. They're babysitting, but at the same time, you can't say they grew up together if she's a little kid and they're watching over her. It's forced.
Are they not still growing up?
No. In this time, if we got a fucking kid from Wonder Woman that's 16 years old, give or take. It's at the bare minimum 16 years old from this point, which puts Damien and John somewhere in their 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's way not growing up with them.
I'm I'm in my 30s currently, and I still feel like I'm growing up. I'm going to be honest with you. Right, you can't tell me there's a small part of you that doesn't feel like there's still some growing up to do.
I mean, everybody's got growing up to do, but
exactly.
That's individual. That's not saying that, you know, I'm not growing up with my sons.
My point is...
I'm not growing up with my kids.
The three of them are like found siblings. They have a sibling connection. The three of them. Definitely John and Damien, but mm-hmm. with Trinity is like the little sister they never had. Very little sister.
Sure.
Yeah.
I hope after this run is done, she never shows up again.
Oh, she will. She'll have her own miniseries. Don't you worry.
I fucking hope not.
Written by Gail Simone.
I'd be seriously so sad. I'm like, you brought her back to DC to write a series, and that's what you put her on?
Yeah, well, that is Wonder Woman.
Yes, it is.
That's our show.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so top three and favorite moment if you had one. Go.
All right, my top three is War Journal.
Right.
Second place goes to Jay Garrick, the Flash, and first place goes to Catwoman. And then for my favorite moment, my man, I'm gonna take the cheap one out. It's gonna be the end of the Flash where we get those two pages showing all the Flash family members together. I thought that was great. My second favorite moment was, and this is bad, but seeing a ball of fire with a chunk of meat in it made me really curious about what the fuck is happening in the Catwoman next issue.
Yeah. For me, it'll be Catwoman number three, then Green Lantern, then Jay Garrick. Or my favorite moments will be End of Green Lantern, where Shepard pulls out the Book of Oa, of all fucking things. Did not see that coming million years. But if I'm picking a second favorite moment, it's the Wonder Girl trio messing with Sergeant Steel. It was the only good part of that fucking issue, let's face it.
Yeah, it really, really, really was.
Yeah.
That whole... I'll tell you the one thing that pissed me off more than anything in that entire book was the messing with history. Kept changing them into different people. Now, if it changed how they looked or whatever, or changed where they were at, you know, what? Okay, but messing with history is not going to turn John into Garth or a cyborg or Lex Luthor.
No,
it's just not. And that was just done. It pissed me off. I'm like, that's not even trying. Anyway, all right.
It felt very Looney Tunes.
Yes. Yes, like I was watching a fucking cartoon. Exactly. Perfect.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's our show. Thank you for joining us. I hope you had fun. I know we did for the most part. For the most part. All right, Josh, you want to send us off?
We can, or I can. Anyway, thanks for watching, everybody. We're going to be back next week, just like always, somewhere near 5, covering all of DC's weekly releases, same geek time-ish, same geek channel. Ish. So that is the show. We're getting out of here, so you have to as well. Be careful out there. And remember, in the Geek Matrix, everybody has a home. In the Geek Matrix, you are not alone.
Peace.
Peace.